Welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solution Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global forum helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. So today we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentives, and interactions are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. They're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I am Marco Nunziata. I'm the co-founder of Nunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to that, I worked in policy and in finance, and my expertise lies at the intersection of economic trends with technology and innovation. I'm delighted to introduce my guest today, who is Dr. Sofia Onoye. Sofia is the founder and CEO of the Sofia Consulting Firm, and she's a 40 under 40 National Minority Quality Forum Minority Health Leader. Her global scientific storytelling consultancy transforms expert interviews, AI, and analytics into actionable insights and compelling narratives for healthcare clients, nonprofits, and universities. She is also the creator and host of the Amplifying Scientific Innovation video podcast on YouTube, which she launched during COVID-19 to elevate the significance of science advocacy, health equity, and influential leadership in sustaining innovation worldwide. She is a board advisor for Dare Bioscience and Biosocial Microbiomics, and former president of the Healthcare Business Women's Association New York chapter. Dr. Onoye obtained her honors bachelor's degree from Bowling Green State University, her MPH from the University of Toledo, and her PhD and MBA from the University of Connecticut, from which she received a Tradition of Excellence Award. She then completed her postdoctoral training in triple negative breast cancer research at Yale, and later joined as an entrepreneur in residence. She's a recent California transplant, and she lives with her family in Irvine, and her favorite pastimes include 90s music, cooking, compelling television shows, and quality time. Sofia, welcome to the podcast. You have a fantastic, really a fantastic resume. So glad to have you.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to hear someone else talk about you, right? Because when you're a podcaster, you're introducing people. So I'm like, wait, who is that person? Is it me? Okay, well, thank you for that introduction.
You are very welcome, and it's more than fully deserved. So, in fact, Sofia, you have a very inspiring personal story. So why don't we start from there? Because I know your journey continues to inspire everything you do. You were born in Nigeria, then you went on to earn a PhD in pharmaceutical science in the US. You became an entrepreneur. Walk us through your story.
So I was born in Nigeria in a small town called Enugu. I'm the youngest of five children. So, and my parents named me Sofia, and this is a little interesting bit. So they actually called me Princess Sofia Nena Onoye. That's like my full name. And the princess is a silent title. I abandoned it when I came to the US because I learned in Nigeria that maybe you shouldn't be called a princess because people have lofty ideas for you. And so I just settled on the name Sofia as if it wasn't also not exotic enough. But my parents had different reasons for naming me. So my father called me Sofia after one of his favorite actresses, maybe his favorite actress, Sofia Loren. And then my mother thought that Sofia, obviously, it means wisdom. It's the Greek word for wisdom. So she's like, oh, my daughter is going to be wise. So I'm like, okay, beautiful, wise. Maybe that's who I'm going to be. And so at an early age, I sort of began to embrace a curiosity that I saw within me. And it had a lot to do with books. And I actually just published my first memoir, also called Amplifying Scientific Innovation. But what was interesting about this in the first part, I talk about my African cradle, is just how our environment influences so much of who we are. So my dad owned a bookstore and my mom was an elementary school teacher. So obviously I was going to read books, whether I liked it or not. So we had so many books around me, but my favorite were the Encyclopedia Britannicas. I thought they were so beautiful. They were beautifully bound. They smelled so nice. And I could go through each page and find something different. I could go through it in chronological order, stuff like that. But that ability to start to research and to get curious is not really something you're taught per se. You can hone it over time. So I found my natural curiosity in my African cradle, and I brought that curiosity with me when I came to the U.S. because, I mean, to the point you made earlier, I did go to school for quite a long time. In fact, I've been in the U.S. now for 22 years, and I've had a PhD for 11 years. So half of the time that I've been in this country, I've had a PhD, which is, I guess it's a good observation. But I always go back to those roots because I think it also influenced not just my curiosity, but my focus in what I do now. So I ended up doing my postdoctoral work at the Yale Cancer Center, working on triple negative breast cancer, which primarily affects women of color, African-American women that are under the age of 40, women like me. So it made sense to work on that. But also at Yale, I had this sort of epiphany that as much as I liked science, I didn't necessarily like being in the lab. It's probably the most friendly scientist that you could meet. I just wanted to talk to people and get them excited about science. And I'm like, what if that's a career? What if my career is inspiring the next generation of scientists, to people that can begin to say, hey, I might be a little bit curious or very curious, but let me start to nurture that because there's imagination there. And as much as I care about anything else, I want to believe that in my own little way, I've been able to spark imagination. And so that's sort of how the story of my life has gone about, and getting to the point where I now finally, during the pandemic, I launched a podcast because I felt there was a need for credible scientific content and the need, again, to spark that imagination, to have people, oh, I didn't know scientific content could be interesting. And thankfully, with the views that we've been able to build on my consultancy's YouTube channel, the Sophia Consulting Firm's YouTube channel, we've been good, like nearly 2 million views, 64 guests interviewed. And my favorite, well, I can't say who my favorite is, one of my favorites, I haven't even showed it yet, and it's my interview with the other Sophia the Robot. But the whole point of this is about the circle of life, whether you're in Africa, whether you're in America, in Europe, in Asia, curiosity, imagination, these are themes in our lives, and then our environment, what influences us and how we nurture that curiosity, especially through adversity. As an immigrant, I can tell you it hasn't always been easy. But I think resilience pays off, and just that natural interest that you have in things will push you forward more than any single person or any event possibly can. So, yay.
I think it's really impressive, and you are a leading and shining example of what resilience can lead to. And you were talking about books and about the tactile feel of the encyclopedia,
yeah,
as you were growing up. And I can really relate to that. You've seen my bookshelf as you were growing up. And I love books. And even now, because I like reading so much, and I find myself torn. So I strike a balance between getting some books on my iPad so I can cram more into a small space. But for many books, I still need the physical to hold it and flip the pages. So it is a really fantastic, inspiring story. By the way, you were talking about your podcast. At the end of this podcast, we'll make sure to mention the websites where people can come and learn more about you and what you do and learn more about your podcast. But let's focus for now on the issue of storytelling. It's fascinating. As you said, you have trained as a scientist, you are a scientist, but you've fallen in love with storytelling and you found that to be your calling. And this is what your consultancy focuses on. So why do you think storytelling is so important? I mean, you talk about scientific storytelling. Is your emphasis on storytelling, on scientific, or on both?
Well, the thing about scientific storytelling is that it's an art and a science. So storytelling is the art itself, the crafting. And then science is science. It's a systematic way of doing things. So it's about taking something that's a little bit rigid and putting a flexible spin on it. I'll give you an example. So I used to be an adjunct professor of chemistry for 4 years when I lived in Connecticut. And what was interesting about that period is that whenever I would start my general chemistry classes, my students would show up to the classroom with the enthusiasm you reserve for dentists and things that are very painful. So, and I was like, how do I make this chemistry class more interesting to them? So I started to think about deductive reasoning, right? So very simple things that I learned, again, thinking about Aristotle, many of the great scientists that I read about when I was growing up. It's about how do you take sort of what's relatable and then show it to people in a different way. So I say to my students, one mole, 6.02 times 10 to the 23, right? One mole of anything has that number. Yeah, that's hard. Okay, let me help you here. What's a dozen? 12. Well, what's a dozen roses? 12. What's a dozen eggs? 12. So that's the same thing. They're like, oh, now we get it, right? So I think that's what scientific storytelling is. It's about making science a little bit more relatable. And you have to be a pop culture fan. You have to know what's going on outside of the lab for that to happen. That's why I mentioned compelling television shows as one of my pastimes, because I think it helps me to relate to the world. So when you're speaking to people, there's this sort of assumption that scientists talk in a pie in the sky, unrelatable manner. And there's a lot of jargon that is being thrown. And that constitutes a stumbling block, right? A communication gap between, again, maybe a patient and their physician, just the exchange of information, even between researchers within labs or people collaborating. One of the things that we're seeing, which is why I've become so fascinated with AI, is interdisciplinary is now no longer such a dirty word, so to speak. We're recognizing that knowledge has no boundaries. And the more we can sort of collaborate, then we can learn from each other. Artists are very good at sort of painting that picture, right? So I think about scientific storytelling as sort of the broad strokes of storytelling. And then you go in there with the fine details. And I don't play with my references, that I will tell you. So even if I'm telling you the most beautiful stories in the world, I'm still going to find those references. And I didn't know my obsession with references. Sorry. This was supposed to be on Do Not Disturb. Sorry, teen. I didn't know about how tedious referencing can be until I tried to do it for a whole book. And I was at some point, I was like, man, this is why people do not like science. But that's what I mean by the relatability. The more you know, the more challenges you face. I mean, I didn't even like chemistry that much, to be honest. I mean, I thought when I became a chemistry major, it's like 27 credit hours of chemistry. I mean, that's a lot. So I took general chemistry, analytical chemistry, biochemistry, of course, organic chemistry, and then physical chemistry. I was like, that's a lot. Chemistry. And then I got a PhD, guess what, in medicinal chemistry. So at some point I said to myself, is it that you don't really like chemistry, or is it that you don't really want to put in that effort? So this desire I have for scientific storytelling comes from me understanding the intentionality that you need to put in an effort to make science more understandable. It's not that easy for people. You can never make that assumption. Chemistry in particular is more abstract. Physics is dictated a lot by the laws, like things that we can, the laws of Newton, right? Things of that nature. We know that. And in biology, it's about life, the respiratory system, things of that nature. Chemistry, we're here talking about atoms and molecules and things of that nature. You're like, but I can't see it. Well, it's all around you though. So I like who I've been shaped to be. And I think that interest in storytelling probably came because I'm the only scientist in my family. So I had to learn to sort of communicate with my family and still make all this technical stuff more interesting. And as we get to the future with AI coming in, you think about generative AI programs, ChatGPT, even programs like Grammarly that are here to take word construction and continue to simplify it. That's where the world is going. But I think that scientific expertise and putting in the fine details, there will always be a need for that. And that's where I come in.
And it's fantastic. But at least the three areas I want to dive in from what you just said.
Okay.
The first one, you highlighted the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration. This is something I feel very strongly about. And I feel that the whole effort of this podcast on ecosystemic futures is exactly centered on this idea, because we're in a situation where the world has become a lot more complex and a lot more interconnected. Knowledge has become deeper. And I think it feels to me like we're losing something, in the sense that you were highlighting how much effort you had to put just into studying chemistry, which was just a little piece of what you were studying. But because now, as a species, we know so much, the stock of knowledge we have is such that it's impossible for any single individual to go deep into every single topic. But if we don't, you had your classical reference to your name, Sophia. So I will make a classical reference to Leonardo da Vinci, who was somebody who propelled fantastic innovation because he was interdisciplinary, right? He could embrace different disciplines. So today, I don't think it's that easy to do it with one single individual, but we can achieve it with collaboration, with interdisciplinary collaboration, to the extent that we can explain to others what we really know. So I just want to highlight this as, and I think in what you do, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that a lot of the value also comes from your ability to explain the things you have expertise in to scientists and business people who are working on other issues which touch upon your area of expertise.
Yeah, it's about tailoring the message to the audience at the end of the day, right? So if you're going to speak with a scientist, we will vibe, we'll throw out all the jargon in there. But ultimately, we've also learned when I work with clients in the pharmaceutical industry, for example, we are not the client, ultimately it's the patient. And we're all patients and caregivers in our lifetime. And what COVID-19 taught us was how conscious people become or how curious they become once there's a condition they need to investigate. And then Dr. Google shows up and they reference them first and foremost. But we're also seeing patients challenging their physicians more and more through the power of Dr. Google. They go in there, it's like, hey, I researched my condition and I researched my medication, and people are becoming more and more informed. But even on top of that, what social media has created is an amplification effect, right? People are speeding it up. You could be anywhere and I share something on LinkedIn and you will see it in real time, right? And that's the fascination. And so information will spread. Sometimes wrong information actually spreads quicker than the right information. And we learned that through COVID with all the stuff that people were talking about, drinking bleach and things of that nature, and then how quickly it spreads.
And here you're coming to the other issue I wanted to touch upon, which is on the scientific communication, especially touching on healthcare, the issue of trust. First of all, I'm one of those people and my physician hates me. Because I go in having done tons of research on anything he wants to talk about. So he hates me. But you mentioned COVID-19 and there was some spectacular disinformation going on. Mm-hmm. There was also communication, insistent communication on things that then, or rather, official communication of recommendations that later turned out to be wrong, and things which were labeled as misinformation, which then turned out to be actually correct. Such a messy environment.
Yeah.
What are the challenges and what is the best strategy to build trust with people and patients?
Yeah, I mean, trust is an interesting one because if you look at specific demographics, like African-Americans, because of the Tuskegee syphilis study, Rita Lacks debacle, there have been events in the past that have led to mistrust of the healthcare community in general, right? If you look within the Hispanic community as well, you'll see that often gaps, sometimes they don't have physicians that are bilingual that speak Spanish. And so it presents against, and can I trust them? I don't even know what they're saying to me. It's one of the things that I've seen as a strategy. A lot of pharmaceutical companies now are investing in sort of early career student development, where they're thinking about the pipeline itself. Are we raising enough people that are representative of the demographic so that when you go in there, if you're bilingual, you'll have someone there that can cater to you? So I think trust as a human need is sometimes hard to define because it might mean different things to different people. But ultimately, I think it's just this idea that I can believe what you're saying to me and you care about me as a subtle way within the healthcare community as well, because trust has to be delivered in a way that is caring. And what we see, which is why I appreciate the shift towards value-based care versus fee-for-performance services in the past, where it's like, oh, let's get as many patients in and out. It doesn't work that way. We need to spend time with patients to understand what they're going through and to tailor that our prescriptions, our recommendations to them. And again, one of the things I discussed with Sophia the Robot, which is the interview that is going to air tomorrow on my podcast, but we talked about personalized medicine. And the idea that with tomorrow, it's about finding the right dose for the right patient at the right time for you. And what AI is doing is to help us with that, to speed up that drug discovery process, right? Because one of the things that we've seen, it takes 10 to 14 years for a drug to get discovered, to get approved, to go through that whole clinical development process. And the probability of success is horrible. I don't think we would accept that in any industry where only 1 out of 5,000 or so molecules actually become drugs. And then think about the millions, sometimes billions of dollars that are invested in these drug substances. And then who is the person that pays for it ultimately is the patient, right? So there's a lack of access. So what you've seen, and I think it was in 2019, there was a study that was done by, I think it was Pew Research, and it was about the pharmaceutical industry being the most hated in the US Oh, sorry. And what's interesting about that is a year later, COVID happened and we saw some of the efforts were being made to bring vaccines around. And then that started to change. But a lot of what it is when you tell people from my school industry is like, oh, price gouging. Can we trust what's happening? Do they really care about us? If you talk about the physicians, and the patients, if you hear again about that trust, if you go in within labs and things of that nature, there's just where we are, and that we're talking about open access data, sharing more, transparency. I think that's where the future is heading. Where in the past you lock yourself up and you focus on the work, now we are encouraging people to share more. And by sharing more, you can build trust more naturally across multiple communities.
So this is actually very interesting. It brings up, I think, an interesting question, which is the following. Your work is based on data insights. So you're a scientist, you based your work on data. You've highlighted in our conversation now something which is very important. You mentioned that there is a trust barrier often for specific communities like African Americans or Hispanics for very good reasons. And this is also reflected, you've pointed this out in some of your writing and speeches, in a problem of incorrect representation of populations in clinical trial data, and also undermines not just the trust, but the efficacy. And now, though, you also talked about personalization of medicine. So short term, I think the emphasis, you would say, probably has to be on more representative samples in clinical trials, but will personalization of medicine eventually break this barrier because we will get on really one-to-one personalization?
Yeah, I know. I gave a talk during LA Tech Week, and I was asked to really talk about personalized medicine and value-based care. I was also asked to talk about diversity as well and how AI is going to play a role. The thing about AI, like anything else, is a pattern recognizer, right? So you look at patterns and you recognize it. So ultimately, AI will work as well as the information that we feed it. And if the information is already biased to begin with, then I'm not as bold in saying AI is going to solve all our problems, because it's not, because we have these systematic issues that sometimes get trivialized and oftentimes are not articulated well enough or by people that are considered to be credible enough and all that, right? So it creates that sort of systemic issue where no matter what technology might be, we are not getting enough of the people that care, enough of the people that are actually the representative population to have an input in what we're designing. Clinical trial diversity obviously is something that I have talked about on my podcast quite a bit. One of my favorite episodes. See, favorite comes up again. I try not to use that. But I did two clinical trial diversity panels back in 2021 during the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference, which is the largest healthcare conference in the world. So it was aired around the same time because everything we're doing then was virtual. And what was interesting about this, there were 2 5-member panel discussions, people from pharma, people, patient advocacy organizations. I had someone that was looking at clinical genetics for African American patients, just different backgrounds, right? And I thought that it was a good way to say, we think in intentionally about making sure that the therapies that we're developing are representative of the population, the demographics that we're in. So if you look at during COVID-19, that was something that came up because I think 3 to 4% of the COVID-19 studies had African American patients who happened to be maybe 12-14% of the population. So there was again an underrepresentation. What was interesting about that was also that African Americans and Hispanics were dying more from COVID-19 than any other population. Yet somehow that's still underrepresented in those trials, right? And for my podcast, we're actually talking about cancers. And again, it was, I think, 1 in 4 studies actually had sufficient representation of African Americans. So it seems for the most part, we're not seeing enough. And if we're developing the best drugs that are tailored for you, but not really for you, then we're not really personalizing medicine per se. So I think there's a lot. And people like me sometimes have a challenge with industry people because it's like, well, how do you want us to solve that? Well, we could start by thinking about recruitment. And I'm grateful to see companies like Pfizer. I used to work with Pfizer as a scientist and as a marketer. And it's good to see companies like that actually sort of say, hey, we're going to have dedicated clinical trial diversity people. And I interviewed a couple of them for the podcast. One of them is Sandy Amaro, and she's a clinical trial diversity operations lead for Pfizer. Or she was. I think she has a slightly different role now. But what's interesting again is just that if we're not conscious enough about any problem, we're not able to solve it. And that's why I feel like in my own little way, I obviously my podcast is watched by a very small fragment of the world's population. But I think in my own little way, I've always wanted to make a difference and to say, hey, even if you may not know about this before, perhaps after listening to this or watching it on YouTube, we can begin to think more consciously about the way we go about doing clinical trial research.
It's very important. In fact, the problem of misrepresentation in clinical trials is so huge that I remember reading that there are some pathologies in which the issue is not even just underrepresentation of some ethnicities, but it's men and women. So there are pathologies in which the studies have been, the focus has been almost entirely on men.
Yeah. The gender diversity is also an issue as well, right? And that's, again, are we thinking about the population demographics and ensuring that the drugs that we're developing are representative of what we have out there? Women still make up roughly 51% of the population, make 80% of household decisions. And yet, even if you think about women's health itself, only 4% of R&D dollars go into women's health because it's underprioritized and undervalued. And so that
4%, only 4%.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm highlighting that because it's a stunning number.
Exactly. And it's and I obviously am a board advisor for Daré Bioscience, and I've been on 7 that boards for the past 3.5 years. And we've had plenty of time just to look at the data and to say, why is it that Wall Street is not responding to women's health stock indexes the same way they would respond to an oncology one, right? And my background is in oncology, but right is right and wrong is wrong. So I think, if you do want something to happen, unfortunately, you have to find a way to amplify it with your voice or to invest or find people that can partner with you to get the job done. And so that's sort of my whole philosophy about the whole issue. But it is an issue. Clinical trial diversity from a gender perspective and a racial and ethnic perspective. And again, even feeding the AI systems themselves to make sure that we don't have the same biases being replicated and propagated into our future.
Yeah, since we brought the attention on to the company side, so we initially talked about the impact on consumers and patients and building trust.
Yeah.
Now we've shifted the emphasis to companies, the companies that produce drugs and the medical services. Can you tell us more and give us some examples of how scientific storytelling helps shape and change the decisions through which healthcare products and clinical trials are conducted and healthcare products are then being developed?
Oh, yeah. I could give you one example. So Pfizer has a Change the Odds campaign. What's interesting about this is a partnership with the American Cancer Society. And I had interviewed the CEO of the American Cancer Society, Dr. Karen Knudsen, for season 4 of my podcast. So what was cool about the work that is being done is to help to heighten. So roughly 1 in 3 people are going to be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime. And so how do you manage that initial diagnosis, the shock, the, oh gosh, is cancer the death sentence, which a lot of people still think it is. And then what we're also finding, of course, is that a lot of people that are getting diagnosed with cancers at a later stage, think about lung cancers, for example. I think I worked with a company, a big pharma company as well, that was looking to develop a lung cancer portfolio. And one of the things that they found is that the early intervention obviously would make a difference, but many of the lung cancer patients were coming in almost at stage 4, which obviously for anyone that knows anything about cancers, and whenever you hear stage 4, even from the movies, like, is that a good thing? No, it's not a good thing. It means that things have advanced to a point where, you know, being survival makes is a little bit lower than it could be. And so what's interesting to highlight about that is that, again, if you think about demographic, because I like to sort of integrate the conversations that we're having, a lot of people that end up dying from lung cancers are actually African-American men, and also more likely to be diagnosed at a later stage, more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes, and more likely to live in certain parts of the U.S. where there's a high incidence of tobacco smoking, right? So those things still matter. But that's why I think, and it's not because I have a master's degree in public health and I've studied epidemiology, but I do think it's really important to ground yourself on the why. Like, no matter what you do in this life, it starts with that question, like, why are we doing this? And that's, for me, I never, ever stop thinking about the patient. And again, if COVID taught us anything, is that we're all patients or caregivers in our lifetime. So I like that scientific companies, pharmaceutical companies too, are thinking about patient advocacy campaigns, hey, let's find a way to get to the patient, to feed them information, to help to build that trust, for them to know that we're not just here to throw medicines at you. We're also here to help you through a process and to know that people are thinking about you one step ahead, which is why I gave the example of that campaign. So I'm seeing a lot of those sort of patient-centered, like patient-centered work. And I like that we even have patient-centered homes. There's a lot of focus now on the patient themselves. And I think it's the right time. I mean, you can't personalize medicine if the medicine is not centered on the patient. So I think through the work that a lot of pharma companies are doing, the campaigns that I mentioned and such, the social media campaigns too, you can see a lot of their presence now on social media relative to 10 years ago. So it's not so out of touch. It's like, oh, I feel like I can connect with these people, whether it's Johnson & Johnson, Novartis, whomever the companies might be, they all have a pretty strong social media presence. And they're all sort of doing the same work in terms of having foundations and thinking about early career training and getting people help sooner, making sure there's more representation of different types of ethnic groups as we train the future of medicine. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and I can't say one company does it so much better than the other. I just give examples, but I think holistically speaking, when it comes to centering our focus on the patient and building trust and making science more accessible, I think we're doing a better job now than we did 10 years ago. Thanks to technology.
Yes, indeed. And I'm wondering on this topic, Sophia, whether you're seeing either already a trend or the potential for combining the scientific storytelling that talks about treatment to patients and the public to also scientific storytelling that helps on the prevention side. I'm thinking of the background we're operating within the U.S., where people would know the numbers. They know that health spending in the U.S. is enormously high and is disproportionate compared to clear or classic health outcomes like mortality rates, longevity. And now it seems to me part of it is actually explainable in the sense that part of it is because it's in the U.S. that we carry out so much medical research and so much trials, and we end up paying for it and subsidizing to a large extent also some other advanced economies. But part, it seems to me, also because not enough emphasis is put on prevention. How do you see this from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to the right person. Remember, I have a master's degree in public health. And that was my first graduate degree. I remember I went to a medical school interview and then I was talking about global health and public health. I'm like, do you know clinical medicine is just you're focused on your patient? I'm like, really? I really don't know if I can do that. I like to think about the totality of the population. And I even think beyond America, obviously, I think about the world itself and the impact these scientific innovations have worldwide. So obviously, the pharmaceutical industry, it's a business, right? Like anything else. And if it's a business, you have to ask yourself what makes you the most money. And when people go to hospitals, they expect to get something back. It's like, well, I went to my doctor, I had a pain and they gave me a medicine or they did surgery. They did something. Something has to be done. And I think sometimes pharmaceutical products provide that thing. What we're finding is that if we focus more, as you rightfully noted, on prevention, then tertiary care would not be so much of the focus, right? We need to think about preventing diseases before they happen, which is why I gave you that example about the Change the Odds campaign, where it's like, hey, how can we improve diagnosis rates? How can we get women, for example, to go for their mammograms once they turn 40? What if they have insurance issues or barriers? How can some of these pharmaceutical companies through their patient care programs help some of these patients early on? Right. And then through just also maybe thinking about how we train our physicians, because it all starts somewhere. And if we keep using the same curriculum and we haven't sort of tweaked it to reflect today's world, to reflect of what I talked about in terms of patient-centered care versus sort of traditional medicine that was maybe a little bit more paternalistic, where you go to your doctor, you shut up and then they tell you whatever they need. Things have definitely changed since then. So I do think sometimes these types of conversations can seem idealistic because, and I know at the end of the day that it's still a business. You also have insurance companies and lots of stakeholders that will still benefit from tertiary medicine. And there are benefits to them benefiting from it, don't get me wrong. But I do think that if we thought about things like vaccination, there's still a lot of vaccine hesitancy. There's still a lot of false information around vaccines. And then what we're seeing more outbreaks. You hear about measles outbreaks. Like, why should we still be talking about measles? It should have been eradicated a long time ago. But then I'm also quick to remind people that in sub-Saharan Africa, okay, every 2 minutes, a child dies from malaria, and that could have been eradicated a long time ago as well. But then people are like, well, that's Africa, right? No, people are traveling more. You get on a plane, do you know who is next to you? Do you know where they've been? Do you know what they are giving you, what you're giving them, right? And so if we keep this sort of not in my backyard approach to primary care and preventative medicine, then we run the risk of probably even oversaturating our hospitals with too many people, where we probably don't even have enough hospital beds to deal with that. Or we start to run out of medication. And I'm not going to talk about a certain obesity medication that people have been running out of, because now there's a lot of prescriptions for that. But at the end of the day, those prescriptions are helpful. But for me, it still comes down to lifestyle modifications, no matter finding the right diet, some exercise. Just those little things go a long way in extending our longevity. And the final point I will make is one of the best parts about coming to the U.S. for me was I thought about longevity. I thought about my grandmothers. I never had a grandmother. They all passed away before I was born. And I say to myself, okay, let's make this easy. What's the life expectancy in the U.S.? Okay, what's the life expectancy in Nigeria? There was probably 30 or 40 year difference, depending if you're a man or a woman. And I was like, well, there you go. Off to America we go. And as slightly funny as that might seem, it's still a kind of morbid to think that still many people in developing countries that are dying at 50, 55, and you come to the U.S., people live, men probably around 79 years and women roughly 81 years. There's that sort of length of time. And a lot of that has to do with our lifestyle. And if we already have that pretty good, and Japanese people have the longest life expectancy, I think people in Cote d'Ivoire have the shortest, but one way or the other, if you think about life expectancy as a metric for quality of life, for all the technological advancements that we've made, the only way we can continue to preserve that and extend that is A, to integrate technology to understand how we can use things like even 3D bioprinting of organs and tissues to sort of get replacement parts that we need, and also to get down to the root of it to make sure that people are being encouraged to have a pretty healthy lifestyle, not just when you're sick, but as often as possible, because our behaviors are probably the main reason for anything that happened to us, whether it's physiologically or physically, has a lot to do with that environment and how you nurture it.
You brought up another very interesting topic and a very difficult one. It's one that I've struggled with in my own field, which is economics. And it's a trade-off between us, however we want to define ourselves as a country, in the world. You know, the way I see it in economics is you will have followed some of the debates on global growth and globalization, where there has been, understandably, a lot of complaint and recrimination about the fact that some sector of the workforce in the U.S. and other advanced economies have suffered from globalization. So they've lost their jobs, standards of living have been compressed. In the U.S., so in some of the discussions I've had, I was struck by how very few people think of the other side, which is literally hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty in emerging countries from China to India to Bangladesh. And to the point that when you look at the global income distribution, the global income distribution has actually become more equalized, even though the income distribution within countries like the U.S. has become more unequal. There are difficult trades, and the one you're highlighting is even more powerful, because you're pointing out that we tend to invest a lot less in curing diseases like malaria, which are still killing huge numbers of people in emerging countries, even as we spend enormous amounts of money on elective surgeries, cosmetic surgeries, things that are important, but they don't save lives. But what you also pointed out, and here is where I would like to hear your view and whether you think this can be a game changer, is that as the world has become more globalized, diseases also travel more. So diseases don't remain confined to individual countries, and not addressing health in other countries has an increased risk of spillovers across the world.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think that global viewpoint is one that we had for a brief period of time during COVID. I think something about the social distancing measures and everybody being at home at the same time, you're like, okay, let's really start to think about infectious disease. And what's interesting with mRNA vaccines, for example, right? The mRNA vaccines that were used for COVID-19 can also be engineered via AI and a bunch of other technology to also address different diseases, oncology and things of that nature. And what we've seen with companies like Moderna, GSK, I think even with AstraZeneca, is that leveraging that sort of that platform without looking at chronic diseases, because, and I don't blame them, in the U.S., that's the leading cause of death. And the U.S., as you rightfully mentioned, I think 40% or so of the pharmaceutical industry revenue comes from just the United States alone. So there's a lot of money to be made. And if you think about, even if you're a physician or if you're a scientist, there's always pressure beyond maybe what your ethical values might be. And you have to do your job ultimately. So if you had a patient and they feel like they need semaglutide and you don't think that they do, but, you know, they insist like, yo, my friend, my sister, my cousin, my brother, or somebody else had taken it, why are you denying me? And then it turns into a legal issue, then you're in court trying to defend it. So I think that complexities that obviously, understandably, get in the way. But I do think the same way we're open to finding vaccines for an infectious disease when it affected us personally here in the U.S., is the same way that we should be open to thinking about what's going on elsewhere. Unfortunately, organizations like the Foundation for the NIH and the Gates Foundation continue to do really good work when it comes to thinking about genomic controls and controlling malaria from the source itself before we even start to think about therapies and such. So I'm grateful for that, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
I have one last question, but it is the most important. How do we get more Sophias? How do we get more women of all ethnic backgrounds in science and medicine?
I know. See, I started with Sophia the robot. I thought that it would be, and it was funny. It happened like serendipitously. I'm like, I've always known about Sophia the robot, but does she know me? So yeah, I reached out to her and within 15, 20 minutes, they gave me access. Like, okay, this sounds like a good idea. Bring her together. And again, I can't wait to share that podcast tomorrow. But it comes down to what I was sharing with you about my African cradle, right? So going back to sort of my roots where I came from and knowing how much girls are still discouraged from studying STEM. Or even if you look at functional roles within the pharmaceutical industry, women are usually placed in HR roles. It's not, they're not the head of R&D here. I mean, obviously, there are always going to be outliers, but there's still a lot of room to grow. So we get more Sophias by amplifying scientific innovation in my case, but no, it's an amplification effect, period. It's really about coming together and talking and finding synergies with my LinkedIn network. And for us professional types, I'm not Beyonce. I don't have like 170 million people on my Instagram, but on my LinkedIn, I have 17,000 people. And that's a pretty good place to start because 10 years ago, I had zero. I was just starting out at Yale and I didn't quite know how to connect with people, but I connected with people through storytelling. And storytelling is about relating to people. And I think we find more Sophias, we find more women in science, we find more female founders, more anything, if we can find ways to relate with people. And that's something that I've said both time and time again when it comes to how we communicate, is that we can break those barriers by saying, hey, I know I might have all these degrees and all of that, but there's still things I like 90s music. Do you like 90s music? Stuff like that. And those are the things that endear us to people. So if we can find the why behind why we do what we do. For me, if you're in the healthcare field, if you're in science, it really comes down to that patient impact, because that could be you, your mother, your sister, somebody else. So if we can find the why to justify our day-to-day work, remember the prevention bit that we talked about, and to get excited, inspire imagination, inspire people to connect with you, then they would want to do things. But without that excitement, how can I be excited if you're not excited?
And our episode, where should the audience go to find you online and to find your podcast?
Awesome. Good question. So the one-stop shop for everything is the sophiaconsultingfirm.com. So www.sophiaconsultingfirm.com. And over there, we have now a bookshop, a video podcast channel, and I'm working on an online class hub because I want to build out a class on scientific storytelling skills, how to improve on that. So that's the main hub. And on YouTube, it's also Sophia Consulting Firm, or you can just type in Amplifying Scientific Innovation. We have a whole channel, a bunch of episodes, panel discussions, one-on-one discussions, different types of people. Just pick whichever one you want. Or you can just watch the recap, be like, okay, fine, I'll just catch up on the recap. Flexibility is the power to knowledge. So here, and obviously I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably my big social media thing, which shows how nerdy I am, really. But hey, it's okay to be a nerd.
It is indeed. Sophia, Dr. Sophia Onoye, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for a fantastic conversation.
Same here. The pleasure is mine. I appreciate the opportunity to connect with your audience, and I hope that we can stay in touch.
Absolutely so. And thanks to everybody in the audience. Thanks for listening. Please do stay tuned for future episodes of the Ecosystemic Futures podcast. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or on socialworks.com, where you can also apply to be a speaker and be a worthy successor to Dr. Sophia Noye. Thank you so much.